The nation's largest cannabis business brokerage, Green Life Business Group, gears up to be featured at the Benzinga Cannabis Capital Conference as one of the set speakers on our M&A panel. Green Life currently has over 150 exclusive cannabis businesses available on the market today, covering over 10 states. To see more of their exclusive listings, visit greenlifebusiness.com. Benzinga's Cannabis Capital Conference returns to Miami Beach on April 11th and 12th. I may be biased, but I'm telling you, this event is a can't miss. Join us to build the foundation of your next game-changing deal with CEOs and decision-makers from leading companies in the industry. We're talking about the next wave of businesses, strategies from the most profitable businesses, and exactly what investors are looking for in a challenging market. Go to bzcannabis.com to meet your next investor, co-founder, and new friends. A little pro tip from me, right now tickets are $1,000 cheaper than prices at the door. Get yours now. Yeah, what's up, Avi? How you doing today, man?
Great. Very excited for our show today. And you know, what's coming up in general, the Benzinga Cannabis Capital Conference, the news we have to share. We'll get into it in a second. Should we roll the credits?
Let's get started. Let's roll credits. Oh, we're back. Oh, I'm hyped. It's Women's History Month. Way better and cooler people than us. As we were doing throughout the start of the month, as we're going to continue to do throughout month in March in one word. All right, I'm trying to make this a little quicker. All right, as we're going to continue to do throughout March.
It's a related. I think it's like when you get, you know, you get the munchies and then you get the munch, which is like, you know, the biggest them of all. It's like you can only get that like once a year, maybe like either for Thanksgiving or the New Year's.
You know what, Javi? We haven't done a product review in a while. That's not an invite today. We need to plan for that. We're not. I mean, maybe. We may give you some time at the end.
Benzinga Pro Squishy Ball.
That doesn't give you the munchies though. I feel like
it's great.
That doesn't help with the munch side of this. But that being said, Javi, your product reviews are awesome. And eventually, again, maybe at the end of the show, maybe on Tuesday, we can chat about what gives you the munchies. Mean Texel, Tilray is popping big. So is Air. Yellen spoke. What's up? Thank you for writing in. We have a lot of stock news over the course of the last 24 hours, Javi. I'm not sure if you have anything specifically you want to talk about otherwise. But I mean, GrowGen, you know, I'm a little torn on GrowGen, right? The numbers weren't great. But that being said, when it comes to what they did in 2022, kind of looking at that larger picture, they did become more operationally efficient. Right. You know, they consolidated their store footprint, which, of course, is not what you want to do in a growing business and growing industry. But we do want them to be able to run their current footprint without a ton of debt leverage. Right. So, you know, when you think about that, when you think about getting more cost effective, when you think about some of the other initiatives they did, it looks like they somewhat achieved them. You know, so 2023, I don't think is going to be one to write home for GrowGeneration, but I do think they're setting themselves up for somewhat of a long-term future here.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I was not very encouraged to see a 34% decrease in net revenue, 51.6% decrease in same-store sales. So what you're saying is, you know, it's very fair, right? Expanding a footprint of what is already declining same-store sales doesn't necessarily make sense over the shorter term. It does position the company for longer-term growth, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, just whatever kind of trader you are, if you like short in stocks, if you like long-term investments, I know what I am. I'm sure Javi knows what he is. Javi, you don't invest in cannabis stocks, so you are the most ethical man on the planet. But that being said, GrowGen was an interesting one to start my day with. Let's pull up Tilray, see what's happening there. Javi, you have any news to go on there, man?
I mean, not that I know of or that I've seen so far. I think, I mean, I'm going off with what Mean Tikal is saying here, that Yellen said safe banking is in review.
We'll believe it when we see it. Maybe we can just, instead of us deliberating on our frustrations over the lack of action on Capitol Hill, we can get some a far greater legal mind than us here in a few minutes from Laura Bianchi from Bianchi and Brandt to chat about her perspective of the industry. Germany going forward as well. You know, yep. I'm probably not saying that right. But that being said, thank you for all this news. You're giving some great stuff to talk about.
Yeah, man. We should bring them on the show.
Yeah.
We did discuss Germany on Tuesday as the news broke. Mm-hmm. Just to reiterate real fast, seems like the adult use project in Germany will be presented briefly. From what we heard, the UN gave them the green light to move forward. They said it looks good. So very, very excited about the German market, 80 million people. Not just me, of course, right? There's a bunch of people that who are very interested. A lot of them have said so in the show. Interesting companies to keep an eye on here would be Tilray, Curaleaf, Fria, and of course some private companies such
Dimican,
as
Cansativa. I mean, there's some really cool companies overseas, y'all. Was it Sanity Group? That's really cool. High Tide up 9% too. When there's no pumping, dumping, do your own research, right? As said with any financial show. But High Tide, to me, it just seems to continue to build their market share more and more. And they don't have worse debt than anybody else. I mean, no cannabis company is the sexiest of stocks. But when it comes to like what High Tide's doing, it really seems to me that, I mean, what are they up to right now? Like 5% of the brick and mortar market share, if not more, since Canopy got out.
I can't say anything, I think, but today I heard something that will be announced briefly, and I can't say which company or anything, but
you can't. Why are you teasing us?
An undervalued.
Why are you teasing?
People just stay tuned. There's a very undervalued cannabis stock out there that is coming out with huge news in the next few days.
It's a tease. Javi, you're a tease. I hate you. I love you, but it's you're teasing me right now. He hasn't even told me. I normally at least get the inside info.
Oh, yeah. I just heard. I will share it after the show. Yes. Now, let me ask you something. Do you watch The Daily Show? And if so, did you see Cal Penn?
I know what you're talking about, and I'm going to let you go for it, but I'm going to be honest. I haven't watched The Daily Show since Stephen Colbert.
Really?
Yeah. It's been a while.
How is that possible? And Stephen Colbert, not The Daily Show. That was Jon Stewart.
No, Stephen took over, bro.
Really?
Yeah, wait, and then he went to a late show.
Are you sure? No, it was Trevor Noah who took over.
No, Trevor took over from Stephen.
From Stephen? Not from
somebody
John.
Call Trevor Noah and Stephen Colbert. Get them on the line. Get them on the line
either
and settle
way.
It.
Either
way. Stephen Colbert was groomed to take over. Stephen Colbert was really funny, and he went to the late show.
Oh, really?
Or a late show. Yeah.
I was not aware of that. I thought Trevor was the first option. That is just a point to learn. Anyway, talking about cannabis.
I don't know why. All right, back to weed. Come on.
Yeah, you know Cal Penn, right? He played Kumar Patel on Harold and Kumar. He played a doctor on Dr. House.
It's How I Met Your Mother. He's been in everything.
Yeah, like from TV to the White House. It's from Dr. House to White House, I should have said. And he did a very hilarious take on Biden's change of heart on marijuana and marijuana convictions. Now go to Menzinga.com/cannabis after this show, of course, and check out our article and the embedded video.
What's up with the theme of weed in The Daily Show, dude, with Chelsea Handler, now Cal Penn? Like,
I love that. I love that. And he made another joke about weed, I think, the following day, about Silicon Valley Bank, right? They were saying, like, this is a favorite bank for all tech pros and anyone who's ever said, this is like Uber, but for weed.
All right. Well, I'm digging the theme. I mean, I hope we get to talk about it more and hear more, you know, from the next weekly host of The Daily Show. Maybe it'll be Seth Rogen. We'll just keep the theme going. I don't know. Just putting that out there. That would be interesting, right? Conan O'Brien already smoked a joint on his show. Maybe he'll come in for a week. Who knows? I don't know. That being said, let's do one more piece of stock news, and then Javi, you'll wrap us up with a few more news. But Cresco Labs reports their fiscal year 2022 earnings up. Revenue is up 3% to $843 million. What about adjusted EBITDA? That is your headline, Javi. You want to dive in there, man?
So just today, but that is down a little bit. Well, quite a bit. $174 million down from $194 in 2021. However, gross profit is up. So it's mixed results here, I think, right? Q4 was not the best one for Cresco. I'm going to say that. Margins are shrinking. It's not a great time for operators.
What happens with Columbia Care with some of these numbers? Obviously, revenue goes up, right? But how does that how does EBITDA look? You know, how do these things look when, you know, if and when that M&A goes through?
That's a good question. I mean, I definitely feel consolidation will help them. We'll probably need to look at what kind of redundancies they have there, like what kind of assets they.
Well, they're already working on it, right, with Combs Global and a few of the others.
Exactly. So, as we said in the last show, right? Like it's no time to predict anything right now.
Yeah. All right. Well, Javi, you get one more minute. Do us a quick rapid fire, my guy, and then we're gonna get to an awesome interview here.
A shocking confession. The Colombian ambassador to Mexico admitted to regular marijuana use, saying he's a regular cannabis user. As bad as it may be for those who normalizing bombing children and stigmatize smoking a joint. Decriminalization and regulation are fundamental parts of the change in drug policy and a priority task for Latin American politics. What do you make of that?
I mean, is it really that? I mean, yes, it's shocking for like the news, but like, is it really shocking?
Oh, it is.
I mean, these guys are all being paid to say what they're saying, you know, like it doesn't matter where, but you know, not to be cynical, I guess.
Then DC, District of Columbia, marijuana expungement bill enacted into law, finally. And some good news out of California as well, where the state is granting $20 million to cannabis farmers for environmental conservation and licensing.
I love it. Well, I mean, some good things happening on the state and local side today. I mean, in Delaware, we talked about them on Tuesday, basically writing a letter to the federal government saying, get your S together. And then I think it passed the Health and Social Services Committee today in the Senate after already passing the House. Overall, it's moving forward there. You know, it's kind of a race between Delaware and Minnesota for the next domino. We've seen a lot of GOP states not do anything. They voted it down. But that being said, I did see a note, I forget from who, but basically they said, are we done now? Like with states legalizing marijuana until federal legalization. And I have to say, it's a resounding no. I think that was a terrible take. I think we will see more movement on the state side, you know, and nothing's, but I mean, Minnesota looks good. Delaware looks good. Hawaii looks good. You know, I think there are states out there that we could definitely see some movement in, and medically, right? I mean, Kentucky, they're talking about it in their state Senate for the first time ever. North Carolina, they're talking about it again still. North Carolina, I'm a little bit more doubtful about than Kentucky, but we had a great conversation with Representative Nima Kulkarni from Kentucky's House of Representatives.
Watch that one
on YouTube. Aaron, drop the link in the chat, man. So that was me and Representative Nima Kulkarni and the Kentucky State Director of Minorities for Medical Marijuana, and I got educated about the history of him.
That without me,
that's you're awesome. The one who decided to go to Spain. You can take that and take it right back. How dare you? How dare you leave me here? But no, guys, take a peek. It's very educational. It was for me learning about hemp and the history of hemp. And honestly, I'm from Kentucky. I had no idea that there was such a rich history for that crop in that state. So, you know, take a look. I think Kentucky could be a more medical domino to fall, not necessarily near future, but not necessarily long term. Maybe, you know, somewhere in the next 6 to 12 months. We will see. They are also doing sports betting there. So it looks like Kentucky might be getting a little bit more liberal. You did not hear it here first. all right.
Okay, let's get to the interview. Enough with the rambling.
Hey, come on, man. And I agree with you, though. Let's bring her over. Laura Bianchi from Bianchi and Brand. There you are, Laura. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. How are you guys doing?
We're fab. We're enjoying the day. It's a beautiful day here. I don't know if it's a beautiful day in Argentina. I'm hoping it is. But wherever you are calling from, we want to hear about you. We want to hear about what you're up to in the cannabis industry.
Sure. I mean, I feel like that changes every 10 minutes, but no. So, I'm a co-founder and partner of Bianchi and Brandt. We're a firm based in Arizona, but we work throughout the US and have been honored to do some international work as well. I have been in this industry since 2010. Started out as a very typical M&A attorney, and I keep saying I'm going to come up with a better story, but it really was sort of, we had some clients who were interested, and I started working on the rules, and it kind of just took off from there, and it's created this entire life of its own. But you know, one of the things I enjoy the most, yes, we are a law firm, but we are very much strategic partners for our clients, and I think anybody who's involved in this industry knows that there are so many things that we don't have either the right professionals for, or that you just have to know 20 different things to make one decision, which is totally different than, you know, any other industry. And so as a result, you know, we work very hard to be business partners with our clients, not just lawyers who come in and draft a document or stop the deal from happening. We really work as entrepreneurs and work with clients to bring value and help them expand. And it's been a lot of fun. Really fun, Brad.
Love that. I got two things for you. One is,
sure,
you know, a lot of these origin stories, people go like, yeah, it's not the most interesting one. You know, for me, it's kind of the same, right? Like one day someone asked me, hey, are you willing to, you know, sign an article about cannabis stocks? And, you know, 10 years ago, no one really wanted to do it, which doesn't mean that, like, the merit isn't having been willing to do it at the time, right? So not every origin story is as interesting as maybe, I don't know, like Steve D'Angelo's, right? But,
right.
But these origin stories say something about a person going like, okay, I'll take the risk, like legal, reputational, like
yes,
in every possible way, financial, to jump into something that I believe in, right?
100%.
Sorry, you go ahead.
No, I mean, most lawyers wouldn't touch it. I mean, really, it was, I laugh today, right? Because the marketing in every firm out there right now does some sort of cannabis law. And I remember getting letters from the state bar, from the American Bar Association saying, you know, you're breaking federal law. We don't know that you can keep your license. I mean, it has changed so much, but it was going out on a bit of a limb. But it also, for me as an attorney and someone who's always had an entrepreneurial spirit, you know, it was approved by the voters of Arizona, a brand new industry that no one knew what to do with. What other area would you more so need a lawyer or need someone who at least has business sense and knows contracts and, you know, can take those pieces and try and fit it into a very new program? And so to me, that reaction was silly, but it certainly was there. And there was not a lot of folks that were super supportive in the beginning.
Exactly.
So, you know, kind of looking at Arizona, right? I mean, are you pretty familiar? I'm assuming you're pretty familiar with the market there.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. So, I mean, Missouri came online and everybody's excited with the performance there. But before that, really the last major awesome performance was Arizona. I mean, can you tell us a little bit about like why and how, you know, some states roll out successfully, some don't, maybe with an example of Arizona?
Well, I think Arizona did a great job. We're still a limited license state. Now, we have medical and we have adult use, but I think for this industry, the states that have limited licensing that took it in a little bit smaller chunks going forward, it allows them to build a little bit more organically. Now, look, it's easy to blame poor California and Colorado because they were the first. And so the first ones coming out of the gate, we can all look and go, don't want to be them. But the problem is we learned from a lot of those things. And we learned from, you know, a lot of the issues and hurdles that came up from a business perspective, financial, banking, things like that. So I think Arizona got it right in being a limited license state. We, you know, have some of the highest values as far as our licenses, you know, of any of the states in the U.S. Now, when we went to adult use, though, we also created quite a few more opportunities for cultivation. So our market right now is definitely trying to shift and adjust with a bit of a oversaturation with product. And a lot of brands that wanted to come in. You've got a lot of folks that are leaving from California, from Colorado, some of these states that they feel like the legal market is really hard to succeed in. And it's hard to compete with the black market, especially when rules and regulations and costs are so exorbitant. So as they come into states like ours, you know, it does create a bit of an issue from a surplus perspective. However, I also think that makes folks reconsider and look at their business and start to really treat it like a business where we don't just have a license and do everything, right? Everybody in the beginning, like, I have it, I can do it, I'm going to. Okay. Like, it's a little hard to be a master of all things. Some people tried. So I think what you're seeing is a shift in, you know, the smart people going, okay, here's a couple of things I'm really good at. This is what you're really good at. Maybe we enter into strategic partnerships or joint ventures or mergers or things like that. So it, to me, it's not a bad thing. I know it's challenging for, you know, some of the folks that are going through it, but this to me is the next step in creating a sophisticated long-term industry.
Absolutely. And, you know, looking at that, a sophisticated long-term industry, there's going to be a lot of discussion from now until whenever Congress does anything about the state of M&A. And understanding the combination of businesses in this industry obviously slowed up a lot. You know, when we look at the theme of the year, it's somewhat operational efficiency for these companies. You know, it's survival and being competitive in 18 months. But where does M&A fit into that? You know, what can we expect to see in this industry this year? You know, public company, private company, doesn't matter to me. But, you know, in terms of this industry moving toward maybe more, you know, larger companies or more combined markets, whatever that means to you.
So, you know, M&A has evolved a lot in cannabis, and I would say in a lot of ways for the better. You know, when this first started, there was no due diligence. Everybody had to run at the same time. It had to be done yesterday. Nobody wanted to wait for documents, details. Like, we just wanted licenses. That's all we wanted. We wanted to make deals. You know, that gave me significant agita, your Italian partner. So, right, it killed me in the very beginning. I was like, could you stop for 5 minutes? And then all we saw was, you know, so many lawsuits and problems and issues because nobody was handling this industry or even the M&A side from a typical business financial perspective. There was no other time you would go, I don't care what you did to your house. I don't care what's in it, what's under it. I'm just going to buy it and I'm going to give you five times more. Okay. So you know, it wasn't great. It was challenging. Great that the money was flying, but you know, as we fast forward, I think what is interesting now is we're having to operate in a traditional fashion, right? People talk about EBITDA. That was like that didn't matter before. I don't care. It's a license. I can make it functional and I can make it successful. We look at those things now. So it's, you know, it again takes it out of that sort of juvenile infancy stage where everybody just wants one. We don't care how it happens, to saying, okay, what actually makes sense? And so I think you're seeing more M&A now that is strategic. You're looking at some of the smaller folks that are saying, look, I may not be able to survive on my own, but I can, a couple of us, right? And we gang together, become, you know, a group that does a lot of things well, and we can compete against some of the larger ones. Even the big MSOs, I mean, sure, they're there and they have their own sort of place, but we've seen them struggle too, as a lot of them got rid of boards, got rid of executives, pulled out of different states, right? Their stocks have gone down. So you're seeing shifts even in how they do business as well. So, well, yes, M&A has, I'll say it's gone, it's subsided a little bit. It's more so, to me, it's just changed and evolved. And so you're just seeing more reverse mergers, more combinations, more joint ventures. And again, I know it's aggravating, but as a lawyer and as a business person, I think that's much better for the industry and who's going to remain in the long term, because you can only run to the roar so long.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's funny you bring this up. You know, I was chatting with a CEO a couple of days ago, and he said, I'm actually the only one who's left standing of the original public company CEOs from like 6 years ago. And I stopped to think about it. And I was like, dude, that is insane that an entire industry, out of an entire industry and in a group of whatever, like 300 publicly traded companies, only one has the same CEO as they did 5 years ago.
I'm going to spend the rest of the show guessing what you're talking about. Please continue.
Listen, I've also got clients where I'm the only one still standing that's been there from the beginning. Okay, we're going to bring in a new board and a new executive team. Let's see where we go. But it's true. There's been tons of changes and, you know, some for the better, some maybe not, but it is. It's really is like dog years. We have changed and grown and evolved so fast that we are nothing like it was 5 years ago.
Elliot calls me the international man of mystery. Nothing mysterious. All my life is on social, but you know, I am very interested in the international scene. That is like a constant for me. And you just mentioned you started doing some international work. I am curious, what can you share? What can you tell us? What are you doing and what can you share in terms of your view of international markets that are interesting?
Sure. I mean, so, part of this, obviously, we've always had to work and do work and specialize with different partners in Canada. That's been from the beginning. But, we're starting to see an interest in South and Central America, obviously, with Malta and Germany is sort of teetering on being the next one. There's definitely a lot of interest from a business perspective and an investment perspective. Now, it always creates complications because of our federal illegality, of course. But, Israel has been so far ahead of us in certain aspects of the cannabis industry. And you've got other nations that are along those same lines. To me, again, it brings in more sophisticated thought process, equipment, products, research, things that we haven't been able to do here because of the federal illegality. So to me, it's not only interesting and it's fun to be able to do this on a bigger scale, but it does. It opens the door for us in what we can do for the U.S. cannabis market and how it continues to evolve and grow. So it's also different. I mean, Central and South America are always funny to me because it's very much a federal system. So I remember the first time we had spoken with some clients in Colombia, and they said, "Sure, we can get licenses, we can grow it. There's nowhere to sell it." I was like, "Okay, that's probably the opposite of what we have." It's a little bit, so it's unique and it's different than what we see in the U.S. But it's fascinating, and there's definitely a lot of interest, especially if you're trying to get rid of the illicit market, which in a lot of these countries has devastated them for years.
I'm just curious, internationally, when you work with these companies, is it that same racing mindset that you saw on the U.S. side, in these newer markets? Or was that specific to us and being impatient
Sense
over
to be
here?
maybe a few of them. I feel like a lot of these markets are, they have a little bit more of a laid back approach than the US did. It's because they're more federal programs, because they don't have the same, how do I want to say it? Usually when one country does it, it's something that across the board the countries will start adopting, right? We're very specific in the US that each state is so different, and we have very, I'm of course it's a good thing, but very US, very pro, like, these are my rights, this is my state, you stay over there, we stay here, and we do things differently. I don't see as much of that in some of the international markets. Again, for better or for worse, it's just a little bit different. It tends to be more of a community program. They tend to focus more on the individuals who are purchasing and having, what type of store structure experience you have versus building it into an industry and a business like we have in the US, where you're getting, trying to grow into these really big conglomerates. And so, will it shift and adjust? Sure. The more that you see traditional money and the VC guys and all the investment bankers starting to move into, this industry, that dynamic starts to change. But I think it's a little bit smaller scale when we're looking at it internationally.
Can I do one follow-up to that, Javi, before you
Sure.
dive in? I'm interested. I mean, when do you think, I guess from a legal perspective and your mindset, this could just be as simple as when it's legal federally, but we might start seeing more partnerships between US-based companies and international companies. And maybe I should expand that question to hemp companies. But I know we have, M&A from, say, like a Flora Growth that owns CBD companies and a Village Farms that owns Texas CBD companies. But is there something more maybe on the horizon between, internationally for our cannabis industry?
So I think, just even in my experience, right, we have a lot in Arizona. We've got a couple of groups that do a lot with the Netherlands and their growing systems with their greenhouses and all of these things. And so, I think as you see our programs evolve and become a little bit more business friendly, because I'll be honest, with that example, one of the struggles was if I'm doing a partnership with someone from another country, most of our state programs require you to have some sort of card or some sort of, authorization to go into cannabis facilities. To get that, you either have to be a US citizen, you have to have a state license. There's different requirements that I don't know if they really intended it, but sort of prevent out of, other folks from other countries in coming in and going to these facilities. And so it was a struggle. We've got your equipment, your processes, even if we have the most beautiful contracts and we license things the way that, and we've got your recipes, all the things that you do. If we can't bring you into our facilities and have you work, one-on-one and really work with the team and work with the plant here, it's really hard to replicate. So I think we've seen a lot of changes and a lot of adjustments with some of the regulatory groups where we have different ways to get approval and have folks on site. And again, when that opens up the doors to these other countries, I think you absolutely see partnership, especially from an equipment perspective. Now, supply chain, that's its own issue. We could talk about that another time. So we could have, so that's putting a dent in everything, whether you're in the US or internationally. But, I think it's as we advance, and have different our programs advance, I think then you've got more opportunity to do partnerships with folks in other countries, you know, assuming we can make that all work. And of course, federal legalization would make that much simpler, but when that will come.
You know, international, one of the things I like to think and actually bring up, right, is in most countries, it was women who were the main drivers for legalization, right? And I feel to a certain extent that was reflected in the initial regulations that most countries saw, where the focus was placed on the patients, on the well-being of people, right? And in most cases, that means that home growing is allowed. Actually, it's regulated first because it allows for immediate access, not access in 2 years when the first product is approved, every license is issued, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
Why has the U.S. done that so differently? And like, you know, maybe I want to get your perspective, both your opinion on this and why it happened. I suspect I can foresee the answer. But then also, how is that like fully legal, right? How is that respecting of human rights, right? If we're saying this substance is legal, but you're not allowed to access it in this specific way.
I feel like there's a lot of ways there's a lot of answers I could give that could be a whole nother show. No, you know, I absolutely think you're correct in that. There was a poll years ago that women tend to make 80% of the household medical decisions and tend to move towards more naturopathic, you know, remedies. So it certainly is something that is more popular, especially when you have medical programs. There are alternative methods, alternative therapies, things like that. So I think you absolutely saw that. I think because the United States, and I don't want to generalize that it's us against the whole rest of the world, but we see it in some of the Latin American countries too, is that there has been such a just say no to drugs, and drugs are so bad. And this is part of that. And if you bring it in, your kids are all going to turn into, you know, drug addicts are going to drop out of school. They're going to deal with heroin. It's going to be a mess. That's been the message for so long that I think the fear is if I let folks start growing it at home, they're going to then start participating in the illicit market. They're going to be selling it. Then it's going to blow up into something bigger. And it doesn't matter what kind of a legal program we have, because it's only going to help the illicit market. Not accurate, but I think a lot of that fear mongering played into it. You see it a little bit in Latin America, and rightly so, right? They're concerned about an industry that is, you know, for a product that has cost millions and millions of people their lives from the illicit market. So, you know, I think there's a lot of socioeconomic. I think there's a lot of history. There's a lot of pain points. There's a lot of PTSD. I think there's just when you come into a place and say, hey, I'm going to take something that historically has been bad or historically has been illegal. And not only am I going to legalize it and give you a process, but I'm going to let you just take it and grow it at home. It's a little too far to begin with, right? That to me comes a little bit later as people start to really understand the plant, the use, and start to really respect it versus we go from here to here. People start to panic. And I just think it's too much change too fast for a lot of folks.
Very interesting. Laura, no, thank you for that. Yeah. So I think we are coming toward the end of our time here, but we do want to do this, you know, for all of our speakers this month and guests this month, I should say. Being a woman in this industry and being, you know, one of the few women at the table day in and day out, you know, what is your advice to other women getting into this industry, to other women acting in this industry that are trying to get ahead? You know, what can they do and what can we all do to better more equality and more equitable landscapes?
You know, you have to advocate for yourself. If I'm speaking selfishly, as I've gone through my career, there is, you know, and maybe this sounds a little cheesy, but no one hands you anything. And especially in an industry that I think we started out having a little bit more control. And it, again, once the sort of typical and traditional money comes in, it goes right back to that same sort of I tease, it's all the, you know, older white guys, and it's okay. I'm not mad at them, but it shifted. I think for women though, there is so much opportunity and there is so much growth in this industry. You just have to be creative and fight for yourself and not settle for things. You know, as women who have, and I say have made it, we're of course always still growing and there's so much more to accomplish, but it's also, we've got to turn around and help the women up behind us and make sure that there are more opportunities and making sure that we're getting in from the ground up, that we're looking at a wider array as we look for executives and we fill boards and all these different things as this industry grows. There's so many smart, successful women out there. It's bringing them to the table. And sometimes it's just on us to do that. You know, I don't know it's hard to make these sort of sweeping rules and regulations. And, of course we try, but to me, it's women that have made it that we've got to turn around and really help and want to train and mentor the next generation so that that continues. And we, continue to move into these places, investing in women-owned businesses. I've got some powerhouse female friends that we love to go out and go, okay, you've got this new brand. Like, let's get behind her. Let's help her when she doesn't have access to maybe mm-hmm. some of those typical VCs and things like that. And you can put your money where your mouth is. And that's how the brands come out. And as you start to develop, or continue to develop the industry, those needs and actually addressing the needs of the female population is how you continue to grow as a company as well. And so, I think it's a team effort in a lot of ways, but you also have to advocate for yourself.
Amen. Laura Bianchi, thank you so much. Bianchi and Brandt, really appreciate you joining us today. We do hope to see you again soon. Until then, let's hope for somebody to pass safe banking.
Yeah. Amen. Thank you guys. It was a pleasure.
Thanks, Laura. Talk to you soon.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Awesome. What a fantastic interview. That was great, Javi. Any thoughts on that, man? I mean, just obviously a lot of international experience, which you don't get often here. So I know you're in heaven.
Yeah, no, I love this. And honestly, I love that she didn't dodge the home cultivation question. Now, it takes courage to say some of these things, right? When your interests are, sometimes your business interests are invested elsewhere. Mm. It's easier to opine when it's, you're a rando on social media, right? Ranting on Twitter. Not so much when there's something real and tangible on the line, right? And saying the wrong thing might cost you some of that. So I really appreciate that. Also, big shout out to Mean Takel, who continue to drop awesome comments in the chat. Tanti Italiani, Argentini, Viva Boca Junior, they say over there. I'm a River Plate fan, which is the opposite team. Also, shout out to Layla from Israel, sending love to all of our friends in Israel. We had a very big loss for cannabis. I think we touched on this already, but Dr. Rafael Mehulam passed recently. He was the father of cannabis research, the first person to really identify THC and CBD as separate compounds, and a trailblazer. We use that word very often here. But if there's one person who really deserves it, that is Dr. Rafael Mehulam. So
great insights, man. No, it's good. Very, very, very good insights. Appreciate that. And yes, we did touch on it, but I think it's important for us to know why he was important and why he was significant to this industry. I will say, though, this industry is still young. There's a lot of room for a lot of trailblazers here, including you. You're like one of the most OG journalists on the planet here.
So here's someone you can follow, right? To a certain extent, like, he has a few successors, right? One I've been following very closely is Dr. Dean Nairi, and it's spelled D-E-D-I-M-E-I-R-I, Didi or Deddy.
Maybe you should just follow Javi on Twitter, and he's going to say, he's going to tag that guy on Twitter. How about that, Javi? That's what's up. I'm not going to let you spell the whole handle out here. That's not going to happen. God love you. All right, but now you have an excuse to follow Javi on Twitter if you don't already with his thousands of followers. You can follow me too. I choose not to say a lot on Twitter, so I'm less interesting, but you should still follow me. But that being said, y'all, this has been a fun episode. Very insightful interview. Lots happening on the earnings side, and we're just getting started on these reports rolling in. So stay tuned to Cannabis Daily every morning, Cannabis Insider twice a week, and then, of course, Benzinga.com/cannabis for all your news throughout the day. Javi, last words to you, my guy.
BZCannabis.com. Come join us in Miami, April 11 and 12th, Benzinga Cannabis Capital Conference. April 13th, the Benzinga Psychedelics Capital Conference. Just
gonna be fun.
I'm tired of just repeating this. You should know it by now. If you're not there, I don't know. Be there or be square.
At least check out the agenda. Check out the agenda in the QR code top right of your screen. Check out the agenda. It is STACKED stacked in the word, in the letter spelling of Javier. All right, you guys, that's it. We're out. Have a great Thursday. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week.